Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. On the show today, we will return to a topic that we have discussed before, perhaps not in a while, but certainly we have discussed before, and that's global climate change. And one of the things that we want to try to do here in our conversation is to concentrate on the effects of global climate change on our part of the country, on the Midwest. To what extent can we say what the result is going to be over time if the trends we see and have seen continue? And we'll be talking about some of what you will find in a report that was recently released. As a matter of fact, I think it was a month ago. This is a report of the U.S. Global Change Research Program. It's led by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And our guest here this morning for the program is one of the contributors to the report. His name is Don Wibbles, and he's professor of atmospheric sciences here at the University of Illinois. He says that one of the things that you'll find if you look at the data and look at this report, that it is in fact the case that in recent decades, average temperatures here in the Midwest have increased. The growing season has been extended by a week. Heavy rains have become more common, and these are all trends that he says we expect to continue. We'll talk about more of this in detail and, of course, invite questions here in this part of the show. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So questions are welcome. We just ask people, please, to keep your questions relevant and keep them brief. That way we can get as many callers as possible in on the program, but certainly anyone's welcome to call. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you, David.
We appreciate it. This is something that we have been talking about for some time now, and we'll get into this in some detail and some depth, but let me just ask as a way of starting out. Now here we have a new report. It's been out about a month. And periodically, we do have updates on what it is that we know. Do we now know anything that's really new? Is there something that can be said now that we could not have said a year ago?
Definitely there is, which is why we got asked by the federal government to develop this new assessment of our understanding. Mm-hmm. First of all, this report we put out called Global Climate Change Impacts the United States – is the most comprehensive analysis that has ever been done of the U.S. and how we may be affected by this very important issue, namely how humans are impacting our climate system through our emissions of greenhouse gases and particles. We have a number of new measurements. More than ever, we're able to substantiate that changes are occurring in the U.S., that are important and meaningful, and also a lot of new data analysis, a lot of new modeling studies, all of which are in the same direction that this is one of the most important issues we're facing.
Mm-hmm. On the average, global temperatures have increased how much?
About 1.5 degrees.
All right. And it seemed to me that there was not long ago that we were saying that it was one, and the average was 1 degree. So now we've gone up a half degree?
Yeah. So if you look at the last 12 years, the 10 warmest years on record in human record of taking global temperatures, which is about 150 years, have been so the top 10 have been in that last 12 years. So we've had the last couple of years have been slightly cooler, as everyone noticed. But even so, 2008 was the eighth warmest year in record. And the reason for the cooling in the last couple of years is primarily because there's a large La Nina event, cool water off the coast of Peru in the Pacific Ocean that tends to lead to cooler temperatures overall.
Hmm. One thing certainly that I'm sure that it's true that climate is a complicated thing. There are all sorts of things that go on to determine climate. One of the big points of debate seems has been for a long time has been in what we're seeing here in this increase in average global temperature, and then there are things that go with that that we can talk about. What has been the role of human activity? Can we really say that while human activity might not be 100% responsible for what's going on, that it is the prime mover of what's going on?
Well, yes, more than ever, we have very strong evidence that human activity is the primary driver. There is natural variations in the climate system, and the climate is subject to changes in the solar flux, the solar output, and other factors that can drive natural changes, much like the La Nina event in the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. By the way, we may be going to an El Nino event now, which might lead to an increase in warming. But the evidence has gotten to be stronger and stronger that human activities are driving the changes. In fact, if you really were to look at all the major analyses, you know, what comes out from different national academies of sciences around the world, the analyses that are being done by various professional science organizations, they're all in agreement that this is one of the most important issues facing humanity. And we need to figure out how to do something about it, because it is clear that the cost of not doing something will be far greater than the cost of actually trying to attack this problem. Mm-hmm.
Is there much difference in, if you look at what various people say, what various groups say, and the contribution of human activity to the warming trend? Are there, you know, for example, some people to say, well, it's 60%, or some people to say that it's 80%, or some people that say that 90%. And even if that was the case, does that really matter if it's 90% or if it's 70%?
We don't tend to look at it that way, because it depends on what period you're talking about. Mm-hmm. If you talk about climate periods, which is the order of 30 years, it's clear we've seen a very substantial increase in temperature over that time, and that or changes in climate in general, not just temperature. Clearly seem to be only be able to explain because of human activities. A number of studies have been done now that show that we cannot explain the significant temperature changes over the last 50 years without incorporating the effects of carbon dioxide and other emissions related to humans.
One of the things that we'll talk about here is you and your people that you have, not just you, but the people that you've worked with, have made some projections of what might be likely to happen given a couple of scenarios, looking at the emissions that are responsible for this warming, looking at, well, what if we manage to cut them down and keep them relatively low, or what if they're relatively high, and then make projections out essentially for it to the mid-century and then to the end of the century. One of the questions I think a lot of people have is, given that there are fluctuations in climate over time, how can you make projections, or how do you make projections about what's likely to happen 40 years from now or 90 years from now?
Yeah, so when we make projections in the future with these models, which are very much, I mean, the physics in them is very much like the models that are used for projecting weather. And one of the arguments you'll get from the public often is they'll say, well, you know, weather can't be predicted for more than a couple of days. How can you predict for many decades? The advantage we have is that weather is affected greatly by chaos. And so we just can't put the initial conditions accurately enough into a model that's used for projecting weather. But when we look at climate, we're looking at the long-term averages, the long-term variations, the statistics of weather, those chaotic terms all drop out of the equation. So we don't have that issue. So as a result, we're able to use models that we've very carefully verified against the past to then make projections for the future based on our assumptions about those scenarios of emissions, of, you know, how much humans continue to release carbon dioxide and other emissions.
People can go and they can look at this report, and I certainly would suggest people do. One thing that you have on here as a graphic that's very dramatic shows the projections of what would be likely to happen over these two time frames. And the way that you do is that you have here a map of the United States, and you're looking at, let's just say, if the emissions causing the warming continue to be on the low side, you say, okay, if that happens and we go, let's just say go to mid-century, if that happens, if this trend continues, it would be as if we picked up Illinois and we moved it and set it on top of almost, we set it on top of Mississippi.
In Tennessee.
And Tennessee. So it's like we took Illinois and slid it down a couple of states. By the same token, you say it would be as if we took Michigan, the lower part of Michigan, and slid it right down and essentially picked it up and dropped it on top of Indiana. That, in effect, that's what we would be talking about.
Walt Robinson and I came up with this concept. Walt was another professor in our department. About a decade ago, I give many, many talks to people and to Congress and about climate and the importance of this issue. And it was always difficult to get the point across. You know, you go over people's heads way too easily. You just and people didn't get, well, what does it mean that it might be a couple degrees warmer? And so then we came up with this concept: is what if would be an equivalent place for the state of Illinois to be, if its temperature and precipitation were essentially to move around in the U.S. And so what we found is by the end of the century, with a high scenario, you're talking about the climate being more like that of eastern Texas. Now, my youngest moved to Dallas, which is about equivalent to the kind of latitude we're talking about for central Illinois by the end of the century. Anyway, moved there last year, and this last week they've been seeing every day being above 100 degrees. Well, that's something we don't see here in central Illinois. And so with the projections indicating that temperature, you may see a month of such days by the end of the century unless we really do something about slowing down our emissions of these greenhouse gases, so reducing emissions from fossil fuel use, we're going to see that kind of climate change, and that's a very different climate we're used to. So, I've shown that before Congress. Senator Durbin liked it so much; he's shown it several times before the Senate, because it really gets across the message about what kind of things are likely to occur.
Well, and even if you go on your low emission scenario and you only go to 2050, that's only 40 years. And I don't know how many of us will still be here in 2050, but some people, we'll all hope. People, I'm sure there are people listening to us who will be here in 2050. Even so, we're only going out 40 years and you're going on your low emission scenario, that's still going to be a very significant, you know, that there's a big difference, I think, between living in central Illinois and living in, say, central Mississippi.
Certainly true.
Big difference. So it would be the kind of thing that within the next few decades, if the trend continues, definitely people are going to notice.
Yes. And you know, we should be noticing now. You know, even now, over the last 50 years, we have seen an increase in severe precipitation in the Midwest by 30%. That's pretty significant. Yeah. You know, so we're already seeing a number of different changes occurring.
And maybe other thing we mentioned real quick, and I get a caller here. I'll get to that. And that is that the your average date for last frost has gotten pushed forward by about
a week. Here, overall in the U.S., about 2 weeks. So other places are even more than you.
There has been a significant noticeable increase in growing season.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And if we talk about agricultural impacts, the discussion is a complicated one because there's both good and bad. And it's clear that farmers, as good problem solvers as they are still going to face a number of challenges.
Yeah. All right. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Don Wibbles. He is a professor of atmospheric sciences here at the University of Illinois, also a professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. We're talking about climate change, trying to talk some about what it means not just for the country but also for the Midwest, our part of the country. And again, this is the result, some of the things that you can find in a recently released report on global climate change impacts in the United States. It was commissioned last year, was released about a month ago. This was produced by the U.S. Global Change Research Program led by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And our guest was a contributor to the report. So questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we will talk with someone here on a cell phone on our line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Am I correct? It means all the stuff that I, all the information I learned in college a couple years ago is basically thrown out the door.
About what?
All the learning. Here's the thing. I know scientists that can rebut what you say, and this is kind of. I wonder. I don't think anybody really knows. To be honest with you, we haven't been studying this very long. I mean, this whole phenomenon has been happening since the 70s. And, I mean, everybody started really getting into it back in the 70s. Nobody really pushed it. But, from what I understand, from what I've learned, we haven't been studying the environment since, you know, we started studying the environment in the late 1800s. And now we're coming to, you know, I guess what I'm trying to get at is there's a lot of questions I have about how we determine whether this is right or not. I've lived out here in Illinois for a number of years, and I've seen the climate change here several times over, you know, but I've been out here since the late 80s, and what I'm hearing, what I'm seeing is what we had, say, a decade ago. It's repeating itself, and I thought everything went in cycles. I mean, we've had 3 ice ages. We've had the planet has changed itself several times, and it's all in the carbon dating, it's all in the rocks, and there's other ways that we've found out that it has changed. And I don't think really seriously nobody knows them. Now, does that mean we're polluting the planet? Of course not. I think we are. I think that we have to take a serious look at how we get our energy. But, you know, I on an everyday basis, like right now, I pulled over and I'm talking to you at a truck stop. And some of the crap and the garbage that I see laying around here, just the garbage and, you know, overflowing trash cans and things on the highway people throw out all the time, I think that's more of a serious problem. And with the housing trend, that building things, building highways and building roads and curbs to where the water used to go into the ground, now it goes into an aquifer somewhere else, and it's by the time it gets there, it's polluted. That's the kind of things we need to start looking at. I think seriously, are we harming the planet? You know, personally, I don't know if we. I'm not going to go one way or the other. I don't think we really know. And
well,
so I'm around another 50 years, maybe.
You raise a number of points, and let me give the guest a chance to respond. And you can take it how in whatever order.
You know, there's so many different aspects to what you're raising. First of all, there are many issues that. Yes, we are facing about our environment. The concerns about climate change, I think, is one of the most important ones, and it clearly exacerbates a number of the others. Climate change isn't going to happen in a vacuum, so it's going to interact with other changes occurring, other environmental effects occurring. So we have to be concerned about that. Let me go back to what you mentioned, first of all, that we've only known about this for a short period of time. Actually, the understanding of the greenhouse effect, the fact that because of these gases in our atmosphere, water vapor, carbon dioxide, and a couple other gases, that those warm the planet by about 55 degrees Fahrenheit naturally, allowing us to actually to live on this planet, because otherwise there wouldn't even be life here, at least as we know it, was actually discovered in 1822 by Fourier. Famous mathematician. In the late 1800s, a famous chemist, Arrhenius from Sweden, actually did an analysis by hand. It took him many months to do it, using a very simple model of the climate system, just doing basic radiative transfer. And he was concerned that the fact that we were burning all this coal and oil at that time, and particularly coal, that was going to lead to an increase in the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and that might cause a change in the temperature of the planet. He actually, by hand, back in 1896, did this analysis and showed that yes, you could end up with an increase in temperature of as much as 5 degrees due to a doubling of the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Well, we've now gone from about 280 parts per million in the pre-industrial levels to over 385. You know, we're rapidly going to approach a doubling within the coming decades. at the rate we're increasing the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. So we have known about this for quite a while. Our understanding of the climate system has increased greatly over the last 60 years because of the capabilities in making measurements from space, capabilities of making very advanced models of the climate system that represent all the physics, chemistry, and biology that is going on. And so our understanding has increased substantially. Basically, I can tell you that we cannot explain the changes that have occurred in the last 50 years without human activities having played a major role. It is not the sun. We know that the solar flux, we've had very excellent measurements of the solar flux from space since 1978. We know that it's not the sun that is causing those changes. We know that that there aren't other factors in nature that are causing the changes. The only explanation that makes sense is that we're driving the change.
I want to thank the caller. I got somebody else I want to get to real quick. Let me just raise one other point that he raised, and often people will raise when we have this conversation, and that has to do with this question of what sort of consensus there is, or is there consensus among scientists? Because people will say, well, I'm sure that we could go out and find some scientists who would say, well, I think what we're seeing is just a natural kind of fluctuation in temperature, and I really don't think that human activity has that much to do with it.
Certainly you can find people like that, but it's not what you see in the peer-reviewed literature. You know, what matters to the science community, the way we judge ourselves, is through using peer review, which means if we write a paper about science, it goes through an analysis by other scientists to see if it's of sufficient quality and sufficiently explained to before it's published to make sure that, you know, this is a real finding. The report we just put out, as an example, went through very extensive review. Every single major U.S. science government organization did a review of it. 13 major scientists did a review of it. And then we had a public review where we got hundreds of additional comments that we responded to. It has been very well vetted to make sure that the quality of the science is accurate and up to date. That's the way it works. So if you look at the question of consensus, there's a very strong consensus in the science community in the community that is really dealing with this problem and through the peer-reviewed literature. Where you're seeing misinformation presented is generally in the media and in blogs and some books. It's very well hidden sometimes, making it look like it's real science, but it's not. And it's not peer-reviewed. It's not analyzed to the same degree. And often repeating the same old stories that we've handled in the science community many times over. I think people are greatly being affected by that misinformation that is out there.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Donald Wobbles. He's a professor of atmospheric sciences and professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering here at the University of Illinois. Was one of the contributors to this report that we've talked about, and certainly if you would like to look at it in detail, you can read it online. This is Global Climate Change Impacts in the U.S. It was commissioned last year, just made public about a month ago. This was a report produced by the U.S. Global Change Research Program led by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and our guest was a contributor to it. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and a toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's another caller here to talk with someone in Whiteheath, line one. Hello.
Hi. I was just calling to give some information from – my husband just got back from Alaska, from Juneau, and they went to that glacier that's right there by the town, and the glacier has diminished about 600 feet in the last 2 years, apparently. That's what the docent there at the glacier told them, and it was averaging about 30 or 40 feet a year, and now all of a sudden it's dramatically decreasing, and I wonder if different parts of the world are going to reflect that some places are a lot more dramatic, and then people in the Midwest here don't really see that big of a change, but it may be in some other parts of the world that, say, the poles, and there really is a lot more dramatic, and maybe we would understand better and be more accepting of the facts that are happening out there.
Well, it's a very strong point. We expect the largest changes to occur at higher latitudes and over land, because the oceans have a very large heat capacity, and so it takes a much longer time period for them to warm up. But we are seeing very substantial changes occurring at the high latitudes, and Alaska is a very strong example where glaciers worldwide, except for very very few of them, are decreasing substantially. And you see that when you go to Alaska. I went there a few years ago and was shocked by the amount of decrease in the size of the glaciers. On top of that, though, the permafrost is melting in Alaska, causing damages to buildings. And there's talks about whole towns and communities in the northern part of Alaska talking about having to move their community so they can get it off of permafrost because they're afraid of how it's going to destroy the town.
Well, it's something that also was sort of interesting that my husband and his brothers asked about what would the reason if it was global warming, and the docents wouldn't say anything about global warming. So they aren't going. Apparently, they can't even come to grips with this science. So I guess we're might be in big trouble if we turn our backs on this on the science. So.
Yeah, well, if it was just a few glaciers, you would say, well, you really don't know. When it's when it's 98%+ of the glaciers around the world that are decreasing, you might think that maybe something's going on globally.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have some other callers. Well, we'll just go on here next to talk with somebody in Urbana. Line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just Googled climate change or climate temperature change and got a NASA site, and I see this temperature pattern that I've seen before. And so from 1975 to the present, Northern Hemisphere, five-year mean, it's been going up clearly, strongly. And I'm wondering if part of that is due to changes in air pollution or changes in cloudiness. And then secondly, on that graph from 1940 to 1975, another climate period, it looks like it was consistently down. And so I'm wondering what might have been happening there. And I'll hang up and listen off the air. Thanks for having me yesterday.
Sure, thank you.
Certainly the period since about 1970 have seen a very substantial increase in temperature overall globally and in the U.S. Our temperatures here aren't that much different than they were in the mid-1930s, but that's part of the natural fluctuations you can get locally and regionally. But we're kind of we're peaking above that, and it probably won't be too long before we're well above that. The best explanation for that period since 1970 is the human-driven effects. Now, that does drive effects in cloudiness, and we take that into account in our analyses. There is some changes in cloudiness. There's changes in the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere. As the air gets warmer, you expect it to be able to hold more water. That's been measured. And so we can pretty well explain that. The period from 1940 to about 1970 was a period where there was very little change going on, maybe even a slight decrease overall. And the best explanation for that, and it seems to be substantiated by the analyses that have been done to try to look at the temperature change over the last 100 years using the climate models to kind of check out what's happened, is that the great increase in the amount of coal burning released sulfur, resulted in a significant increase in the amount of sulfur being put into the atmosphere, And that sulfur then gets converted to sulfuric aerosols, and those aerosols have a cooling effect. So over that time period, that cooling effect appeared to dominate over the increasing amount of CO2 that you're also getting from the fossil fuel burning. And it was only until about 1970 where it started to peak out of that. And then also at the same time, we were beginning to realize that the sulfur and these sulfate aerosols and sulfuric acid creates its own problems for crops, for human health, et cetera. And so we started trying to prevent those emissions and slow them down coming out of the power plants. So, and so what we've seen is in 1970 is coming out of that period where the sulfate emissions were so important. There's also some natural fluctuations that were going on in that time period related both to the sun and to some changes going on in the oceans that also contributed to that cooling period.
Okay. This is Focus 580. I'm David Inge. And again, our guest is Don Wubbles. He's a professor of atmospheric sciences here at the U of I, also professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering. We're talking about global climate change at 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I have a couple of callers here. I hope they wouldn't mind waiting for a moment because I want to come back to something we were talking a little bit about earlier and to try to, again, focus on here on the Midwest because agriculture is such a big industry here. Weather's very important. We talked about the fact that one of the things that we've actually seen is a longer growing season. And I suppose some people would say, oh, well, that's good. Isn't that good for agriculture, a longer growing season? You'd have to say, well, yes. You also have to say, well, what else is going on? And there are some things that happened that are definitely at least challenges for farmers.
Certainly. I mean, the other good thing that can go on besides a longer growing season is that the increase in CO2 also helps plant growth. On the other hand, there are a lot of challenges. One of which related to the CO2 increase is that weeds and insects also dearly love the increased amount of CO2. That the fact that insects really like it was discovered here at Illinois last year by some of our biologists. And so you have these weeds, insects, potential increase in pathogens due to the warmer temperatures that are likely to all have produce greater challenges for the farmers. On top of that, as the projections suggest that we can expect that precipitation overall in the Midwest and Illinois will increase by as much as 10 to 20% over the coming decades in the winter and spring and decrease by as much as 10% during the summer. Well, the problem is, as we saw this year, that the increased precipitation in the spring makes it very difficult for farmers to get into the fields. If more of that precipitation is coming as more severe type precipitation, larger rainfall events like we project, then that also makes more of a likelihood for floods and more difficulty for the farming community. In the summer, reduced precipitation, reduced soil moisture, can lead to other issues with the with the crop. And as the temperatures warm, some crops like corn. Analyses have suggested that came out from USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, that temperatures above 95 degrees, if anthesis is going on, that's when the seed is being formed, pollination is occurring, seeds being formed, that if the temperature is above 95 degrees for a few days or more longer, that you could end up with a significant reduction in crop yield. Now, can the agriculture community overcome this through the further changes in the genetics of the crops? Perhaps they can, but we don't know that at this point, if they can or not. On top of that, you have other concerns. Farm animals, cattle, are likely to be affected by the increase in temperatures, more issues with heat stress. as much as our analysis suggests, anywhere from between a 3 to 15% decrease in milk yield in the Midwest. And so that also needs to be taken account of. That may be able to be overcome by essentially keeping the cattle in air-conditioned buildings, but then that has its own cost.
We have about 15 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Our lines are full. We'll try to get everybody in, but you can help us by trying to keep your comments brief. Next, we'll go to line 3, Champagne. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Thanks for having the guests. A great conversation, great discussion here. My question is, are there any parallels in the past that we can look at as to when scientific knowledge has kind of surpassed the public's capacity and will to respond or understand, and how those have played out? That's one question. And related to that is, a lot of this, underlying this, is really public relations, you might call it, awareness issue. And is there any effort specifically to be getting this in an understandable form and trying to develop some center ground where more people agree rather than the extremes of, you know, the sky is falling or everything's fine, don't worry about anything, somewhere in between there where people can understand, well, everybody agrees that this would probably be a problem and that maybe that's not a problem or whatever. Anyway, you know, a public relations issue to get the attention of people with a bigger voice, you know, lobbyists for that matter. I mean, that kind of people who approach it that way. And then when we look to the past, has that happened before? I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
All right. Thank you.
Sure. Awareness is certainly extremely important. That's one of the reasons we wrote this new assessment, which, by the way, you can get from the web off of www.globalchange.gov. That's the website of the U.S. Global Change Research Program, which, by the way, is just a small organization within the government that organizes the science community for looking at global issues across all the different agencies within the government, particularly the science agencies. So you can go there and you can get that report, and that report is written for the public. So it's a 150-page report, and there is an executive summary, which is much, much shorter. If you really want to understand the issue, I suggest you start there, because it is written at the level where without all the scientific jargon, et cetera, so that you can be able to understand that. Awareness is also very important in general. And in fact, the government is talking about trying to have a number kind of special days or more than, you know, special periods of time in each section of the country, where a number of scientists will give small presentations and be available to answer questions from the public in relationship to that report. And so that will be happening in the coming months, and so you'll probably be hearing a lot more publicity relating to that. Looking at the and by the way, the science I'm giving is our best understanding of the science community. It's not trying to be way out there at all. It's trying to just give our best representation of the understanding. And as I said before, you will find disagreements with it in the on blogs and in the media. But I can tell you that that's really very biased misinformation that does not represent the state of the science. Now, going back to past periods, we have a pretty good understanding of what's gone on in some of the past periods. It's always a question of exactly what was happening. What was the amount of output from the sun, for example? How was that? What kind of volcanic activity was occurring? What kind of things were going on that were affecting those past periods? But we do have a pretty strong understanding of the ice ages, for example. We know that the ice ages were initially driven by the pathway of the Earth around the sun, that when it's at its farthest distance, that results in the beginning of an ice age. Now, what we didn't know until recently was that then drives changes in the carbon cycle, because plants on land and in the oceans are going to be affected by the significant increase in ice and colder temperatures, and that that drives more of the change. So, in fact, in the past, a period like the ice ages, you find that CO2 actually lags the initial temperature change, but that's because it's responding, and then more temperature decrease occurs because the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere decreases. We know very well that the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere decreases from about 280 parts per million to about 200 parts per million during the ice ages.
All right. On to Clinton, Iowa, line number 4, a toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to ask your guest if he's familiar, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, with the weather predicting model called ASEMBLE.
No.
S-E-M-B-L-E.
Where's that model at?
Well, in Science Magazine several issues back, it's a computer model that was used because for predicting short-term weather over, in this case short-term, over 30 days, the butterfly effect, the percent of change at the mm-hmm. start had such a big effect after 30 days that they would, I believe it was 51, 52 different estimates, all using the same data, and they'd blend them together,
mm-hmm.
and they'd use that for a 30-day forecast. Are you familiar with that?
I have seen the paper. I'm somewhat familiar with that model, but I know a lot more about other models. But basically, when you look at the short-term weather projection, as I said earlier, you're so affected by chaos that you just cannot do a meaningful projection. In fact, a very well-known scientist that I used to know had predicted that you wouldn't be able to predict weather at its ultimate more than about 10 to 20 days. And so it's not surprising that you would see the butterfly effect have an impact because we just don't know initial conditions well enough to put in those models to be able to do a significant long-term weather prediction.
So you're saying that the longer you go out, it has a tendency to smooth out the ripples, so to speak?
For weather, yes. And so that's when we get into climate, where you're really looking at over long-term time periods, you're really looking at the climate effects, which are where all that chaotic terms essentially go away, and you're really looking at what is the type of weather you would expect to occur on July 16th as a typical year in a typical year, rather than what's actually occurring that day.
And one last question, if I might: when you set up your program, if the purpose of the program is to find global warming, and someone else is interested in finding, let's say that the temperature isn't warming, it's staying the same. If they use different parameters, if they use different time levels at the start, won't that skewer their predictions for both? I mean, in other words, isn't there a chance of error by trying to know what it is that you want to find and then setting up your model to go and find it?
No, not at all. In fact, with climate, we use the observed climate variables for the past to initiate the model. Often these models are started back in like around 1900 and then go forward to the present and see how well the model does up to now, and then do the projections of the future. But they're being driven by changes that you are assuming in the emissions of these gases and particles, and also changes that occur in the solar flux and other natural drivers of the change. And then you see how well you match up. And then it's the changes that you assume for the future emissions of these gases and particles that then is what is produced for the projections of the future climate that we then talk about.
So if you have two different people working on the same project, but they have slightly different assumptions, then that would skewer the.
No, you would still because the drivers from the solar flux and the the emissions of gases, both natural and human-related, of gases and particles are driving the changes. The fact that you might start with slightly different initial conditions makes no difference. And in fact, we actually, with the climate models, we run ensembles because these models do have natural fluctuations in the climate within them. And so you want to take that into account if you're making a projection. So they'll run a number of different cases with slightly different initial conditions because that will then results in the same net climate effect from these drivers, but on top of that, you're going to have the natural fluctuations in the climate system that are generally much smaller than what we're seeing, but significant enough that you want to take that into account in terms of what it might be telling you about any particular time period.
Well, that's very interesting. Thank you very much.
All right, sure. Thank you. We'll try to get at least one more caller. Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Hi. When someone suggests that they know personally a scientist that has a divergent point of view, you should interrupt them and ask them for a name, because there's only a handful of scientists in the country that share that view, and it might derail his line of thought a little bit, too. I heard from, amazingly enough, the linguist and political theorist Noam Chomsky that the MIT model that is supposedly fairly good does not include such thing as the permafrost thawing and release of methane. And the other possible feedback cycles that are possible that would accelerate. Now, I don't know if that's true or whether it's how well these possible feedback cycles, positive feedbacks, are accounted for in the models, and I'd like for you to address that, and I'll just hang off. Thank you.
Sure. A number of the models are now including those type of feedbacks, but the problem is that some of these potentially very important positive feedbacks could make climate change even worse, aren't well understood yet. We don't know exactly how much methane is likely to be released from permafrost or from the ocean areas near the coastlines of the oceans also tend to hold a lot of methane hydrates. And we don't understand very well the processes as to how much that methane might be released. And so the models don't have a very good representation at this point of those kind of feedbacks. We're trying to make sure that we try to account for all the things we have as good understanding of as possible. One of the big concerns is these kind of surprises, if the amount of methane were to increase substantially in the atmosphere, and that being another important greenhouse gas, that you could see even larger kind of temperature changes than the current projections suggest.
We try to get real quick one more. Belgium, line one. Hello.
The Champaign caller covered my topic. Thank you.
All right. Well, we're just about at the point that we're going to have to finish up. Maybe we have a couple of minutes left. Certainly, we would say to people, if you would like to read more about this, best thing to do, and you have internet access, best thing to do is go to the website which you mentioned, globalchange.gov, and then you can read this report. You can read it.
No, by the way, the report is also coming out in book form from Cambridge University Press by mid-August, I think.
Okay.
So it will also be available in your bookstore, I hope.
So people can read it. But again, just as a way of kind of finishing up, we talked about a few things. Is there anything else very specific to the Midwest that the report says you'd like to tell people?
I think the main message is not just for the Midwest. It's for, all of us. This is one of the most important issues that humanity is facing. And so my concern in talking about this and even in my work is what impact is our children, our grandchildren, et cetera, going to see? And what kind of legacy are we leaving them? And we need to be really concerned about this and what we can do about it. And there may be some sacrifices in order in terms of that we need to do something about our energy and transportation systems to stop putting these emissions in the atmosphere. That may have some costs. There are a number of analyses now suggesting that those costs are rather incremental and that, in fact, there's a lot of money to be made by changing the way we do energy and transportation. But we need to make some tough decisions in order to get to that point.
Well, and again, lest anybody have any doubts or questions about what we're talking about, we're talking about here the main driver being the kinds of emissions that end up being released in the atmosphere as a result of basically burning oil, which we do in our cars, burning coal, which we do in our power plants. And that's what we're talking about, reducing that, which would, of course, mean a very significant shift in how it is we produce energy and how it is we get from one place to another.
Yes. But there are a lot of things we can do. There's a lot of things we can do to increase efficiency in our buildings, in our vehicles, et cetera, that can really start us on the right pathway.
All right. Well, once again, if you'd like to read more, well, we've been talking about some of what you will find in a report, Global Climate Change Impacts in the U.S., just recently been released, put together by the U.S. Global Change Research Program, led by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. You can read it online if you go to www.globalchange.gov. And as our guest, Don Wobble, says, coming a little later this summer, it'll be available in book form if you want to take a look at it that way. Our guest is professor in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences and in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering here at the University of Illinois. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David.
I appreciate it.